50th anniversary of Juneteenth intersects with an increasingly urgent Black Lives Matter movement. And can people power overcome the corporate state? All that and more coming up next. Welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for June 18, 2015 on WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Today we have another jam-packed show, this one focused on drawing the links between the 150th anniversary of Juneteenth with today's Black Lives Matter movement and the situation of the global African diaspora. Two historians are in the house today, Harry Jones and Gerald Horn. So as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, starting with this week's headlines. 9 people were killed last night inside an historic African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, in what police are calling a hate crime. Those killed were attending a service at the Emmanuel AME Church, located in the historic downtown section of the city. Residents of the community spoke to CNN.
You tell people to go to work. You right, go to church. These people were in church. They were in church.
In church.
And they violated the sanctity of that. You know what I mean? The ramifications are way beyond that. Just what happened tonight. And this is just unacceptable. This is just unacceptable.
We are communities trying to live and survive. Why do we have to live like this? We have enough issues here now in Charleston. We don't need more. We need peace. And we asking y'all out there in the community to stand behind that.
The Emmanuel AME Church congregation was founded in 1816 and was reportedly an important stop on the Underground Railroad. The pastor, the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, a state senator, was named as one of the dead. Police have released a photo of the gunman and recently released his identity, a young white male, and the dark four-door sedan he drove off in, taken from surveillance cameras at and near the church. Here in D.C., there will be a Juneteenth interfaith prayer vigil for the Emmanuel AME Church at the African American Civil War Museum, 1925 Vermont Avenue Northwest, tomorrow at 7 p.m. In the Dominican Republic, people of Haitian descent have been scrambling after this week's deadline has passed to register their status and avoid a possible mass deportation to Haiti. The Dominican Republic has stripped more than 100,000 Dominican-born descendants of Haitian sugar plantation workers of their citizenship. It remains unclear if deportations will proceed this week, but authorities have reportedly prepared dozens of buses for the trips. Activists around the world are denouncing the deportation plans, and organizing efforts include a proposed boycott of the Dominican Republic's tourism industry. A UN panel has recommended sweeping changes to the world body's peacekeeping operations worldwide. The report comes amid revelations of sexual abuses and exploitation by UN forces in countries, including Haiti, Liberia, and the Central African Republic. Panel Chair Jose Ramos Horta said there must be zero tolerance for such crimes.
This is what has to be very clear. You commit a barbarity, you have no protection whatsoever. You are subject to the laws of the country where you are operating. You know, he cannot hide under the United Nations roof.
Here in D.C., South African youth inspired Tuesday's demonstration and march by the police reform activist D.C. Ferguson, which began at Mount Vernon Square Park and wound through Chinatown. June 16th was selected to remember the 1976 uprising by students in the Soweto Township of South Africa that helped to inspire the global anti-apartheid movement that brought down that country's racist regime. Christina Alexis of the Black United Front addressed the crowd.
You know, in South Africa, Winnie Mandela said the children were so thirsty.
thirsty for freedom, that they were willing to confront machine guns with stones, with rocks. They were willing to get shot down, hundreds of them, for what they believed in, because they were tired of being pushed out of their homes. They were tired of having housing discrimination. They were tired of police terror. They were tired of all of it. They were tired of what we know and what we recognize are the symptoms of white supremacy that we see everywhere. They were tired of it. And, you know, we have to be able to draw a line, you know, to mark where we're going to be tired of it, where we're going to be fed up enough to come out here in droves and make a change. You know, we have to support our youth out here. They're so creative. They're intelligent. We need to make sure that we're giving them the resources that they need. Join an organization that's working with youth. Join an organization that's working against police brutality. We need y'all. We need everybody out here.
D.C. Ferguson protesters continued their demand that D.C. police end the controversial tactic known as jump outs, which include armed undercover officers stopping and frisking people on the street. Well, during the past year, as the Black Lives Matter movement was sparked by the killings in quick succession of Eric Garner, Akai Gurley, and then Michael Brown, killings of black women and girls have also occurred, but not received the same attention by protesters or therefore news organizations. In response, the Say Her Name movement has sprung up to build more awareness of these cases, including the killing of Rakia Boyd in Chicago, Natasha McKenna, right here near us in Fairfax County, Virginia, and Miriam Carey shot right here in Washington, D.C. On Saturday, Baltimore Say Her Name will sponsor an action called Rakia's Rally and Natasha's Jubilee to call attention to these killings of women and girls. With me to discuss the action and the Say Her Name movement is Lene Pindell, an organizer with Baltimore Say Her Name. Good morning, Lene.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. So first, tell us about Saturday's action, Rakia's Rally and Natasha's Jubilee, and what prompted your group to organize it.
Okay, well, myself along with a few other comrades were thinking how necessary it has been to really expand the narrative about police terrorism and black lives to make it more inclusive of women and girls and the women of girls of all identities, those women and girls who may be gender nonconforming, may be mentally or physically disabled, that may not be heterosexual. And so we were thinking how necessary it is to have an event that is free and open to the community and really will encourage this dialogue. And we also wanted to have something that was celebratory, because while we are reclaiming and reviving the names of the black women and girl victims, we also don't want to stop there, because they are much more than victims. So on Saturday, we're going to begin with a march and a protest. And like you already mentioned, we have named that Rakia's Rally in honor of Rakia Boyd. And we will march to three different spots throughout the city. The first one is My Sister's Place, which serves as a home for women who have been subject to domestic violence and also homelessness. Our second stop will be the Billie Holiday Monument. And our third stop will be the community of Penn and North. And at each stop, we are going to share short speeches on what police terrorism looks like for black women and girls. We're also going to be sharing art in whatever form that may take, be it poetry or music. And we're also going to have testimony from the community participants. And afterwards, we're going to have an outdoor celebration, which has been called Natasha's Jubilee, in honor of Natasha McKenna. And there we're going to have music and free food and vendors and giveaways. And then it'll just be a really energizing end to our march and our protest.
Okay. So why do you think that these cases of women being killed by police have not received the same attention as cases involving men and boys? What are some of the things that you all discussed in Baltimore Say Her Name?
I think that there are two things. I think one, there has been a reluctance by the media at large, both historically and presently, to just focus on the lives of black women and girls. And then two, I think concerning the Black Lives Matter movement, that it has really been dominated by a lot of black men, which has been really disheartening, especially since the Black Lives Matter movement was created by three black queer women in an effort to fight for the liberation of all black people And I think that because sexism has been so dominant in the movement, that Black women and girls have really been pushed to the periphery of the movement's agenda. So I think that we have to resist both the racism of the white media at large and also the sexism within our own community.
Okay. So how can people get more information if they want to participate on Saturday?
Yes. They could either give me a call. My cell phone number is listed on the flyer. It is 443-642-8181. They can also...
Say it one more time.
Oh, it's 443-642-8181.
Okay.
Also send an email to sayhername@gmail.com. And they can also find us on Facebook by typing in the hashtag Black Women and Girls Lives Matter.
Okay. So you'll be out for the folks who don't know, Sister Space is at the intersection of Cathedral and Franklin Streets in Baltimore, and that's where this event will jump off on Saturday, and it'll go from 3 to 6 p.m. With a rally and then march. I've been speaking with Lene Pindell, organizer with Baltimore Say Her Name, organizers of Rakia's Rally and Natasha's Jubilee, the Saturday event. Well, Lene, see you Saturday, and thanks for joining me.
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, so those are headlines and happenings. When we come back, the truth about Juneteenth and what it really celebrates with Black Civil War historian Harry Jones. Stay with us.
Oh,
welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition. I'm Esther Averam. Well, tomorrow, June 19th, is the 150th anniversary of Juneteenth, the day in 1865 when the last of our enslaved ancestors in Texas were liberated after Union soldiers, many of them African-American, defeated the entrenched Texas rebel government and army. To mark this historic day, scores of events are happening in our region. For example, the nurses and caregivers of 1199 SEIU will be joining with the Baltimore Say Her Name rally we just mentioned from 3 to 6 p.m. on Saturday. And by joining this action, 1199, civil rights, also a civil rights and human rights organization, is reclaiming the meaning of Juneteenth and drawing the connection to today's struggle for human rights, labor rights, and the particular struggles of women of color. Well, for several years, my next guest has been trying to correct the historical record about Juneteenth and let the world know that it's not just a happy celebration of people who did not know 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued that they were free. Joining me here in the studio is Harry Jones, Assistant Director and Curator of the African American Civil War Memorial Freedom Foundation and Museum, one of the foremost authorities on the role of African Americans in the Civil War. Harry presents a new perspective on the subject and reveals just how extensive and well-organized America's African descent community was in its effort to end slavery in league with the Constitution. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, we just happened to be doing this show after this horrific massacre in South Carolina. So I wanted to first get your thoughts on the significance of this 150th anniversary of Juneteenth.
It is a celebration, or let us say the recognition of the end of a military campaign for emancipation and union. The goal of Americans of African descent clearly in the Civil War was to end slavery. And this celebration is when the last of the 10 states that were in rebellion as of January 1, 1863 was formally brought back into the Union. And it's very important that we understand that the Emancipation Proclamation required enforcement, and that the Emancipation Proclamation was understood by members of Congress, the President's Cabinet, the Confederate Legislature, and Jefferson Davis as a cry for help to African Americans. Indeed, Jefferson Davis told the Confederate Legislature in January of 1863 that the Emancipation Proclamation was, quote, an authentic statement by the government of the United States of its inability to subjugate the South by force of arms, close quote. Or simply stated, the federal government has admitted publicly in the proclamation that in order to defeat us, they need the help of our Negroes. And that's how we must understand the Emancipation Proclamation, issued as, quote, a fit and necessary war measure for suppressing said rebellion, close quote.
So that African Americans would join the ranks of the Union Army and basically allow them to turn the tide in the war.
This is correct. Join the ranks in the Union Army. Go on labor strikes, which were very important in hindering the Confederate war effort. And some of the immediate results of it was the control of the Mississippi River, splitting the Confederacy or the rebel territories into two parts. And Lincoln would say that in 1863, when this was achieved, that was evidence that his emancipation policy was working. And he wrote that in his annual message to Congress in December of 1863.
So, you know, we both started this conversation on Facebook about a more militant Juneteenth. And I guess I had that question because it seems to be kind of like parties, kind of like a lot of times I don't really sense the solemn a celebration, but also kind of recognizing that it was a victory, a military victory, as opposed to just, you know, we's free now, you know.
Yes.
So you responded that, in fact, Juneteenth is a militant holiday. You know, it's not just a happy celebration. So what challenges have you had to writing this history and to give the correct facts about what really happened?
Well, first we must understand that the way the Civil War has been presented ha- has been a part of a white supremacist, or what I will refer to as a white illusionist, because it's the illusion of supremacy, campaign. And this campaign that you see started in the 1870s by Northern Democrats such as Robert Roosevelt of New York was that African Americans, the Negroes, had done little or nothing to free themselves. That they sat around waiting for someone to come and free them. And so what we've seen advanced, even in the explanations of Juneteenth celebrations, is that the enslaved in Texas knew nothing about the proclamation, and when the European descent general shows up on June 19th, he informs them, and, oh, they found out they were free. So we must understand that that's a part of a propaganda campaign, and that many have become victims of that campaign. So to counter that campaign, we go to the primary sources, we tell the truth, and in that way we subvert a campaign against us, and in that way it's militant.
So what have those primary sources revealed to you? I know that it's almost like you've heard the voices by reading the text, the documents. You've like heard these voices of people that contradict this, the narrative and the propaganda campaign. So what do those voices tell you?
Well, one is it actually comes from the Austrian council who's in Galveston in October of 1862. The Union Navy actually captured Galveston in October 1862 after the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation was issued. And the council, the Austrian council, writes a letter to the naval commander, William Renshaw, and he tells Admiral Renshaw that there are enslaved persons from Texas who have run away and been given refuge by the Union fleet. Then he queries Renshaw, if my slaves run away, will you return them to me? And Renshaw says unequivocally, no, I'm not going to return them. So we see clearly that enslaved persons know about emancipation because they are self-emancipating. They're running away to Union lines. One of my favorite slave narratives is John Bates, who's from Limestone County, Texas. And he's 10 years old when this is going on in Texas. And he says that word got around, quote, pretty fast, close quote.
Is that P-U-R-T-Y?
P-U-R-T-Y. He said, word got around pretty fast. And he goes on to tell the story of how the enslaved on the plantation he was on actually went and told the planter, Massa Harry, that they were free. That they told him. He didn't tell them. And then Massa Harry was very distraught and died 15 days later from depression. This is in the slave narrative. So you have these reports. Also, we have African-American soldiers who are there fighting in November of 1863, capturing the southern tip of Texas. One of the battles that I actually really think shows the strength of African-American soldiers is in August of 1864 at Port Isabel, Texas. You have these African-American soldiers who are mostly doing engineer work or construction work, and they have their muskets aside, working with picks and shovels, doing engineer work, and they're attacked by a rebel force that's twice their size, and in quick time, they defeat the rebels. But that's a good example of what these African-American soldiers are like. I often compare their performance on the battlefield to what you might see in a football game or in a basketball game. They're clearly, as Robert E. Lee said, eminently qualified physically to be good soldiers. And General Benjamin F. Butler would say of African-American soldiers, quote, better soldiers never shouldered a musket, close quote. And so there are these stories of how outstanding they were. Then it's the June 19th correspondence of General Gordon Granger. Mm-hmm. Granger has been ordered by his immediate superior, Phil Sheridan, General Phil Sheridan, to issue general orders when he arrives in Texas. Granger is the new commander of the Department of Texas. And Sheridan tells him, when you arrive, I want you to issue general orders informing the citizens of Texas, the people of Texas, that all of the laws enacted by the rebel governor and legislature are null and void, that all federal laws apply, and thus the Emancipation Proclamation has freed the slaves in Texas forever. Mm-hmm. Well, Granger arrives on June 19th. And when he arrives on June 19th, he writes, I arrived here this morning and I found a brigade of the 25th Corps. The 25th Corps. So there's a corps, a brigade of the 25th Corps. A corps would be somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 men at this time, that the size of these regiments. The 25th Corps is the only corps in American history made up of only African-American regiments. The 25th Corps is the Army Corps that captured Richmond, Virginia on April 3rd, 1865, with the headlines here in the Daily National Republican here in Washington reading, quote, "Glorious fall of Richmond, captured by the black troops," close quote. This 25th Army Corps would go on to stop Robert E. Lee's army at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia. Thus resulting in the surrender of Lee's army to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia on April 3rd, 1865. So this is the famed 25th Army Corps that many fear. And when Granger gets to Galveston, a brigade, over 1,000 of these African-American heroes are in Galveston. So certainly the word of the Emancipation Proclamation is in Galveston in the person of these conquering African-American soldiers.
Wow. Well, we are certainly dispelling any myth about people not knowing and kind of walking around in a daze or, you know, wow. So, you know, related to this discussion is the museum's year-long celebration, actually. This is a very important year in terms of the Grand Review Parade that just occurred up Pennsylvania Avenue, the descendants of African-American soldiers who fought in the Civil War. It was very moving, and I had a chance to talk to some of them and play their comments here on the show. But so this year itself is very special for the museum. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of what's left to come in terms of these markers this year?
Well, this is, of course, the 150th anniversary of the conclusion of the war. So since we're telling the story of the Civil War primarily, this is like the drum roll, if you will, of all things Civil War. And now we transition into telling the story of Reconstruction, and that immediate period after President Andrew Johnson pulls the African-American soldiers out of occupation duty in the South. And there's a period before the radical Republicans return to Congress of virtually a return to slavery through vagrancy laws. So it's to tell this story and then how African-Americans are so active. Organizations like the Loyal League, which was the single most important source of tactical and strategic intelligence during this war, actually organize after the Civil War, and this would result in Hiram Revels being appointed to the U.S. Senate, Blanche Bruce being elected to the U.S. Senate, Robert Smalls, the hero of Charleston and commandeering the ship, the Planter, going to Congress, and anti-Klan legislation. So there's a lot to talk about now in the post-Civil War and relating this story to really laws, amendments to the Constitution that our current movements are based on.
Yes.
And really asking for enforcement of the 14th Amendment. That was a critical in 1871 when President Ulysses S. Grant sent a message to Congress and on May 23rd told him, don't adjourn. Because there are these outrages in the South, and you need to give me authority to enforce the 14th Amendment. And so they don't adjourn, and Benjamin F. Butler, a general in the Civil War who thought African-American soldiers were the best soldiers to shoulder a musket, had already written the anti-Klan legislation, and this legislation gets passed. So it's to tell the story of that legislation and how we address events like what went on in Charleston last night. How do we stop it? Well, we're going to have to enforce that 14th Amendment, because I am a strong believer that as long as we're calling our fellow citizens of European descent white, there are going to be those who are so delusional that they will behave like that terrorist in Charleston last night. they will join the Ku Klux Klan, and there will be problems. And we're going to need some enforcement of the 14th Amendment to stop this terrorism.
Yeah. You know, there are so many people who drew parallels to the Reconstruction period with what we faced as a community, as a national community, after the Black Power, the Civil Rights Movement, and we kind of came into the era of Ronald Reagan, and so many of the laws that were passed to ensure voting rights, to ensure housing rights, to ensure equal employment were eviscerated, and it became increasingly difficult to enforce those laws in court. Certain standards created to prove intent, like we have to prove that Darren Wilson intended to kill Michael Brown, or that, you know, that your employer intended to discriminate you against you. And of course, that's very difficult, if not impossible, because you can't be in that person's mind, you know, and you have to kind of get into the psychology of white supremacy to kind of unpack that. But anyway, you have presented some really fascinating. We're definitely going to have you back as the year progresses to kind of map out what was happening then and how it relates to us now, you know. Thank you so much for being with me today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Harry Jones, Assistant Director and Curator of the African American Civil War Memorial Freedom Foundation and Museum, and he's one of the foremost authorities, as you just heard, on the role of African Americans in the Civil War. Harry presents a new perspective on the subject and reveals just how extensive and well-organized Americans' African descent community was in its effort to end slavery in league with the Constitution. And so we'll have to keep talking about that and the Constitution as the year goes on. All right, thank you again.
You're welcome.
Okay, so when we come back, we are going to go to Gerald Horn, and we'll also take your calls at 202-588-0893 so you can join the discussion and stay with us. Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on WPFW Washington 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. Over the break, we heard Center Loop by Robert Glasper. I'm Esther Avarum, and in our activist and sort of, maybe it's might be kind of nerdy world, we really aren't concerned so much with Rachel Dolezal, really, the white woman who was passing for black. We're really more concerned with what is happening with actual black people. Last night there was a massacre, a declared hate crime inside an historic African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, by a white young gunman who remains on the loose. Just last week, Eric Casebolt resigned from the police department in McKinney, Texas, after video surfaced of his brutality against a 14-year-old black girl attending a pool party. And we're concerned about the insanity of fracking and plans to drill in the Arctic, and we're concerned about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty. So that's a whole lot, from police brutality to the environment to proposed corporate global grab, right? So right now, Democrats and GOP leaders are in new legislative maneuvers to rescue the TPP, this trade package, this global trade package. And so with so much swirling around us, I realize that it's the third Thursday of the month, and we are due for a new installment of the F Word, in which we explore the seemingly forbidden, the ways that we are and are not living in a pre-fascist state. Fascist, we're kind of working with the term fascism as described by black revolutionary and assassinated political prisoner George Jackson as the complete control of the state by monopoly capital. So here today to unpack it all, and he's helped us out before. For this month's installment of The F-Word is our favorite, our most favorite geopolitical analyst, commentator across the Pacifica Radio Network, the prolific author and activist Gerald Horn. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
So we started this conversation before this horrific massacre that just occurred in South Carolina. And to give listeners a little background, you talked about how police executions, this type of violence, and not the TPP, this kind of global corporate grab, that these executions are more of a harbinger of pre-fascism than the TPP. That this is something that we have to look at. And do you want to start with your reaction to the massacre and your thoughts on the continued police killing and killing and brutality against unarmed African Americans?
Well, for listeners who may not be aware, just last night in Charleston, South Carolina, Father Emmanuel AME Church, there was an act of terrorism, a political assassination included, as the pastor of that church was also a leading state senator in the state of South Carolina. Apparently, 9 people have been killed. A number have been injured. Perhaps the toll will rise. It was a so-called lone gunman, a young Euro-American man, who came and sat in the pews before taking out his pistol and shooting those parishioners in that particular church. That church, you may recall, was founded approximately 200 years ago. Apparently, Denmark Vesey, who led a major slave revolt in South Carolina in 1822, was a founding member, and after that fact was unveiled, that church was torched. We all know, of course, that there's been a long history of the ultra-right attacking churches, not least in Birmingham, Alabama, September 1963, a message sent after the March on Washington when 4 black girls were bombed in a church in Birmingham. This is a very disturbing turn of events. On top of the state-sanctioned violence, which you've made reference to, that is to say the spate of police killings, we now have so-called individual acts of terrorism. It should be looked at in the context of your discussion about what you termed the F-word, in the sense that this is a symbol of decay and decadence. We know that the political environment is being coarsened and deranged by these numerous wars in which the United States has been involved in. It's very difficult for a country to drop bombs on one part of the planet and not expect other kinds of bombs to explode right here in our backyard, particularly to explode against those who historically have been viewed as the indispensable enemy. When speaking of Africans, who of course fought tirelessly against the slaveholders' republic at the end of the 18th century, then fought tirelessly against the Jim Crow regime that followed it, and as a consequence and as a result, have been viewed as an antagonist. That particular point of view takes on added resonance at a time of economic decline, when you have so-called credible political forces in Washington talking about, quote, taking our country back, when you have a U.S. president who happens to be of African ancestry, who has probably received more death threats than any other sitting U.S. president, when we already know that 60% of Euro-Americans generally vote for the right, that in Louisiana in 1991, 60% of that community voted for a Nazi, David Duke, for governor of Louisiana, certainly it's not untoward to talk about pre-fascism given this state of affairs.
So I guess it would be correct to say that your perspective, as we consider the F word, is not so much on the economic, but some of the other outgrowths of what has been an economic underpinnings that promoted violence and scapegoating.
Well, I would say economic as well. I mean, when we're talking about an attack on the black community, we're talking about an attack on a working class community. The TPP is taking place in the context of what seems to be a conscious decision by a wing of the U.S. ruling elite that a sector of the working class is superfluous. I would say the black working class, which is concentrated disproportionately in manufacturing and in industry and in the proletariat generally, is generally deemed to be superfluous. So when we begin to be killed in the streets wantonly, this is not just a political question, it's also an economic question. I would also say that with regard to the TPP, number one, the right wing is split on the TPP. As you know, a significant percentage of the right wing in Washington are against the TPP, and it's very difficult for any political faction to move decisively when they're split. Secondly, it's not even clear if the TPP is going to pass. Thirdly, I have to say I have a critique of the forces who are opposed to the TPP, the so-called class warriors, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, hardly say a mumbling word about state-sanctioned violence against black people, even though they're officers of the state, which I find very disconcerting and very destabilizing of the anti-TPP movement. Second of all, the point that the left often makes that the TPP erodes the sovereignty of the United States is an argument that I think is questionable at best. What I mean is that it has echoes of the old states' rights argument. That is to say, instead of saying that Mississippi has the right to do whatever Mississippi wants to do on Mississippi territory, it says the United States has the right to do whatever it wants on U.S. territory, even though we know that historically for black people we've required and needed an encroachment on U.S. sovereignty to get justice. We're the ones who need international allies, and to talk about an encroachment on U.S. sovereignty as a reason to be against the TPP, it seems to me, is a questionable argument at best and calls into question the political acuity of those forces.
So, given what we know about the TPP, this agreement allows corporations to override the rules of elected governments, and I guess that's what you were referring to in terms of these sovereignty arguments. And for those of us with a rudimentary understanding of economics and political economy, the TPP sounds like putting global pre-fascism into an agreement, like into an agreement, a secret agreement that no one can see. Even our legislators can't see it. Congressmen, they can see it, but they can't take notes. They can't take pictures. They can't get a copy. But corporate leaders have been able to see and draft this document. So that is the first thing. What are your comments on that?
Well, first of all, to be clear, I am hostile and opposed wholly and totally to the TPP. My only point is that the TPP presumably will be implemented sometime in the near future, and that when it is implemented, it will have a devastating impact on the working class, which is why the labor movement is opposed to it. What I'm saying to you right now is that right now, instantaneously, yesterday, months ago, beginning with Michael Brown, if not before, with Eric Garner in July 2014, a sector of the working class is being decimated, while those who are supposedly hostile to the TPP don't have a mumbling word to say about those particular attacks on the working class. I think what we need in order to oppose the TPP is a united working class movement, and that cannot occur when you have some of our alleged friends hiding under their desks and not having anything to say as our people are being mowed down in churches.
Okay. So you are welcome to join the conversation by calling 202-588-0893. I have this writer and activist, Gerald Horn, on the phone. And even though he's hiding out over there, Harry Jones is still hanging out with me here in the studio. But we do have a caller, and you can join that caller by calling 202-588-0893. Good morning, caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, Esther. Good morning, Dr. Horn. Tespa from Arlington. I just want to say condolences to all the relatives of the people killed, especially the leader of the church. And if this young person kills the teacher off, if they slap you on the left, give them your right, who is he going to save? Racism is fascistic, and it is nobody. But the first targets of racism and fascism are black people, and we need to unite. The same attitude, the same policy by the United States government is killing Africans in Africa. The Ethiopian government is killing Ethiopians. The Eritrean government is killing Eritreans. The Congolese and the Rwandan dictators are killing their own people, financed, installed, financed, supported by the United States. This racist policy is killing us all over the world. We, the first targets of racism and fascism, need to unite. Unless we unite, we'll be attacked and killed everywhere. Thanks very much.
Okay, and thank you for calling, Tesfa. I have another caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah, it's Derek from Manassas. And just a couple things. First of all, this is a horrendous act in the church, and hopefully the perpetrator will be found and guilty, convicted, and one good reason for the death penalty, in my view. Secondly, though, I think that calling this some sort of, this is a crazy person, an evil person, and trying to say that this is tied to what your guest is saying, state-sanctioned killing of African-Americans, it's what leads to a lot of this hate and business, and it's very destructive. I mean, the hands up, don't shoot never happened. That wasn't said. It was part of a false narrative. And I think we're doing the victims in South Carolina a huge disservice by now using their deaths to justify a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, if we're really concerned about African-American deaths, there were 9 people killed in Baltimore in 1 week, and nothing was mentioned. It's because we're killing each other. And, let's be honest here in the narrative. There's bad stuff happens, but I think so often we jump into this mode where we want to use these things for our political gain. I think that's just wrong. And by exaggerating things, we'd end up hurting ourselves. Hands up, don't shoot, never happen. Okay.
Thank you for your call, caller. Because it's actually interesting that I hear a lot of times on right wing TV and radio them putting forward this narrative that it never happened, and it's very interesting because the grand jury process in Ferguson was so flawed, and basically grand jury, we have to put grand jury in quotes because that's what really never happened, right? And so of all the witnesses that testified that said that Michael Brown did have his hands up and who were credible witnesses who were actually there, like maybe of all those like 20 people or dozens of people, only 2 people said that it didn't happen, and at least one of those witnesses has been totally disqualified and has been shown to not even actually be at the scene. So we here on WPFW Pacifica Radio, here in the nation's capital, here in the DMV, we don't accept this narrative, this propaganda that's being put forward by the right wing, and we understand, we believe the witnesses, and we believe the facts as they occurred, not this narrative that people are kind of repeating in that echo chamber, and then they want to use our airwaves to repeat that. So that was my response. Gerald, did you have something to say?
Well, let's deal with another fact that's not contested. Eric Garner was killed on tape by New York City police officers on Staten Island. The prosecutor who failed to bring a conviction against those officers,
not even charges,
elected Congress. He was promoted as a result of his malfeasance and misfeasance. I'm not going to be the lobster in the pot that waits till the water gets to boiling point and I'm about to become somebody's dinner before I begin to squeal and object. Speaking of the previous issue of sovereignty, keep in mind that just weeks ago at the United Nations Human Rights Commission in Geneva, the authorities there put forward scores of demands to the U.S. authorities that they have to answer by the fall concerning killings of black people in the streets of the United States of America. This was done almost without any prompting from us. It seems to me that that's the kind of encroachment on U.S. sovereignty that we need more of.
We do have more callers. Welcome. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, and thank you, Dr. Horn, for bringing so much information to this community and other communities around the world. And thank you for this program.
Just give your name. We know who you are, but let the world know who you are.
I'm just Rick.
Okay. Calling from D.C.?
Yes, from D.C.
Okay.
And one of my real concerns is while all this TPP stuff is being pushed on us, they have our eyes in another direction. They have built this case around this woman passing as the number one issue in America, and our whole democratic and unequal and abusive capitalist system is getting a tighter grip on our necks, and that is one of my biggest concerns. But while that's going on, and the human rights thing with the UN has passed us, and Israel is claiming that there's no problem in killing all of those people in Palestine last year and years before, all of this is going on, and we are concentrating on somebody passing. I think that we should be continue to be up in arms and recognize the fact that fascism is in America, and that and like Dr. Horn warned, we can see the steam, but we don't want to be the last lobster in the pot.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think I can take one more caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Lanham, Maryland.
And your name?
Alex.
Welcome, Alex.
Hey.
You're on the air.
Oh, okay. I'd like to make another comment about Juneteenth. One thing that was overlooked, that is the first holiday created, and only, I think, holiday created by the African community in this country without any assistance of any other community. And they actually bought some land in Galveston where they could hold the celebration so nobody could tell them, get off, go home, go away. It okay. showed a whole lot of self-determination.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Oh, you disagree with Harry?
The first,
about what?
The first holiday really is August 1st. Emancipation Day in the West Indies used to have huge parades in the 1840s. In places like Philadelphia, Boston, New York City, and they celebrated that for many years. The first post-Civil War celebration was actually in the District of Columbia, April 16th, 1866. That's the first, before June. So there's been celebrations of emancipation, before Juneteenth. I think Juneteenth, again, is very important, but the celebration of emancipation is a part of the tradition of African descent folk, in this country.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Do we have one more person holding, Katia, or do we have one more person? Okay, great. All right. Did you have some final comments? I have like 30 seconds, Gerald.
Only to thank you for this program and thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Well, and thank you for being with us. That will do it for us today. I'm Esther Averam, and I want to thank my guest, Lene Pindell of Baltimore, Say Her Name, Civil War historian and poet, Harry Jones, and author and activist, Gerald Horn. A special thanks to our engineer today, Katia Stitt on the board. Thank you for holding me down, my sister. And also, I want to give thanks to Kimon Freeman of WEAC Radio for production assistance on that D.C. Ferguson segment. And thank you so much for listening and calling in and supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. A few notes. At 1 p.m., WPFW will be hosting an hour of open phones on the Charleston shooting. Remember, tomorrow on Juneteenth from 6 to 8 p.m., there will actually be a Twitter conference from 6 to 8 p.m. using the hashtag Freedom150. And I'll be co-hosting that with Shawande. I'm going to just say Shawande because I'm going to mess up his last name, the filmmaker here at Race Man Telepictures. And at 7 p.m., there will be the prayer vigil, interfaith prayer vigil for the Emmanuel AME Church at the African American Civil War Museum. That's 1925 Vermont Avenue Northwest. And then on Saturday, Baltimore Say Her Name will be doing the Rakia's Rally and Natasha's Jubilee 3 to 6 p.m. starting at Sister Space at Cathedral and Franklin Streets, I believe, in Baltimore. And you can get more information by following Baltimore Say Her Name. And also, you can give a call to one of the organizers, Lene Pindell, at 443-642-8181, 443-642-8181. And I think that will do it for me. If you want to reach the show, you can reach us at onthegroundshow.org. And you can like our Facebook pages and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Crisp the Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace. Thank you.